Blog Talk Radio.
Once a man is glad, you smoke like your grandmother.
You want your nature down, a desert wind in view. A shot of fireball, one reason turned to screw. A 40 ounce of steel and silver and the actual brew. I'm so bored of doing nothing, but I got nothing to do. So pour us up the Boilermaker, back around, is there anything to pour us up the Boilermaker, time to knock it back.
Hey, Turnbuckle Turmoil fans, QT and Sun Guy with you like normal here on a Sunday afternoon. Some show notes. If you're looking for some wrestling, Wrestle Club happening today in Boise, Idaho. You also have KDW at the arena in Jeffersonville, Indiana. A reminder for those that are in our neck of the woods, no blue-collar wrestling this week. They'll return next Sunday as they're taking the holidays off this year. And a huge note, if you watch episode 307 of the Sign of the Times, the potential snotty contest edition, Seymour Snot approved the contest. There is now a full-fledged contest commencing. You can guess which mid-2000s television show Seymour Snot was watching as he autographed my brand new Seymour Snot picture that he sent to me. So QT, people can send us tweets. They can send messages on the Book of Faces, the Instagram. They can mail letters however they want. We will give this contest 1 month. So 1 month from today, you can guess which mid-2000s sitcom Seymour Snot was watching as he made that autograph.
Now, Sign Guy, when you say mid-2000, does that include the year 2007? Because technically that was kind of late mid-year or mid-decade.
That would depend on Seymour Snot's perception of such. I presume 07 would still be relevant.
I see, because as you know, one of the most popular sitcoms, it's starring a cast of geeky characters, made its debut in 2007, and it revolves around like the legend and theories of Mr. Hawking, the famous physicist, or at least that's what the song title is. The song title, Big Bang.
Is that going to be your official guess for the contest?
The Big Bang Theory, I would like to take this moment to submit that, yes.
All right, well, I will put that in the official contest notebook, a dedicated notebook for this contest, because there may not be a bigger contest happening anywhere in the world for 2018. What a huge way to end 2017 and start 2018, the Seymour Snot mid-2000 sitcom contest.
Yes, this may even prove to be bigger than the guess how many cups of coffee Casey Carlisle had. I'm not
that
sure I heard who the winner was.
The Golden Songbird won that contest. He guessed it exactly right.
Oh, that's right. Yes, yes. Congratulations, Golden Songbird. And may Golden Songbird, if you're listening, may you have good luck in this contest. Yes. Very good. Now, Sign, I couldn't help but notice that was kind of new entrance music for one of our shows. Was that the Dropkick Murphys?
It surely was not. That was the song Boilermaker, And it was from Bruzy's band. Bruzy, of course, one of our listeners over in Wales.
Oh, okay. Now, what exactly is a Boilermaker, Sangai? What is that drink?
I'm going to have to look that up, but it's also someone from Purdue University. They're the Boilermakers.
Oh, that's true, yes. Now, I think
I'm sure
Boilermaker...
when he wrote the song.
God, now let me see now. I think a Boilermaker is a beer down by a whiskey chaser. I am going to look that up right now. This is very important. It's very, one, it's very important
yeah,
to know.
Yeah, it is
a
glass of beer and a shot of whiskey.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, Sangai, have you yourself ever had a Boilermaker? That's what I'm asking.
I'm not generally a Boilermaker drinker. Now, QT, you have two or three Boilermakers a week.
No, I don't. And I'm not sure if I've ever had a Boilermaker. But if I had, it would probably be a combination of probably Guinness followed by a shot of Hennessy.
All right.
That sounds pretty good, yes.
Now, I believe that to be an authentic Boilermaker, the shot of whiskey gets dropped into the glass of beer.
You mean you drop the shot glass full of whiskey into the beer, or you pour it?
Well, you pour the shot into the beer, and then you just drink it.
Yeah, okay. I was thinking if you put the shot glass into the beer, you know, just to be over the top, outrageous, I think you could chip a tooth.
Well, possibly.
Yeah. Okay. I wonder if Buddy Highway drinks Boilermakers.
I'm going to have to try to get confirmation on that. I'm going to guess he does not, but that is simply an opinion.
Now, what if, Sangai, you traveled over to Russia, Gregor Petrov's area? Could a Boilermaker be modified to, let's say, a beer over there followed by a vodka chaser? It's very important. Vodka.
I don't think it would still constitute a Boilermaker if you did that.
Well, you know, those Russians, they're kind of headstrong. They have their own ways, and vodka is way more popular than beer. Why wouldn't they say, you are bad, you Western influences. A true Boilermaker is a beer followed by vodka. Let's say over there they import Red Stripe from Jamaica, and they follow it with a shot of Stolichnaya vodka.
I still don't think that would make a Boilermaker, because a Boilermaker constitutes beer and whiskey. It's like if you bake a pie in Russia, you couldn't bake a cake and call it pie. It wouldn't be the same.
Okay. You know, just for the record, I'm going to go online and research if they do have Boilermakers in Russia. That's what I'm going to do. Very important to close out 2017 with this. Yes.
Now, QT, last night in Seattle, you missed the final wrestling event of 2017. It was Project 42. You missed a fantastic show.
I have heard that through the grapevine. I was putting in my hours at my new gig. But, Sangai, I heard a fruit pie was delivered. Yes. A fruit pie.
Yeah, it definitely was. One went into the hands of none other than Kellen Wraith.
Very nice, very nice. I can see that Kellen Wraith and I will maintain our friendship in 2018. Now, Sign, I heard that a wrestler from Oregon won the main event, which was the Seattle Battle Royal. Is this true?
That is true. Julian White won the match. He dove off of the railing that separates the fans from the ringside area and Superman punched Nick Radford. But QT, I believe we have a caller on the line.
Oh, okay.
Do we have someone from... Well, I guess not. I guess not. That call dropped. But I do have confirmation from Buddy Highway. He does not drink beer or whiskey, apparently.
Oh, wow. Okay. Can you tell him what his let's say, spirit of choice is? I'm going to guess maybe gin, like Bombay gin, a high-end gin. Yes, Bombay.
Is that because you think Buddy's from India?
Yes. Yes, if you could confirm that real quick, yes.
I'll try my best to get confirmation.
Oh, okay. Now, Sign, in the meantime, while you're doing that, this Julian White, you say he did a suicide dive over the top rope?
It was a Superman punch.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to guess, you know, Superman punch. Now, was this guy very quick in the ring? Did he have a lot of speed, Julian White?
He did, and it was surprising he maintained that because his qualifying match was with, you know, Mike Santiago, and they went toe-to-toe for roughly 15 minutes. Great opening match. And you know how Santiago is. I'm sure he took a lot out of Julian White, but Julian White was able to recover and persevere enough to win the Rumble.
Wow. Well, let's see. If he went toe-to-toe with Santiago, I'm going to say that he doesn't have much body fat on him. I think that's probably safe to say, never having even seen the guy. So he does probably a lot of cardio. So that means his weight is probably down, not carrying a lot of extra weight. I don't know about muscle weight, though. Right off the bat, I'm going to guess Julian White stands about 6 foot tall and weighs 185.
That's pretty close to on target.
Aha! Boy, I tell you, without even seeing a wrestler, I'm very good at guessing a person's weight. Not even seeing video. I hope this streak continues in 2018.
Now, there was a major occurrence of Project 42. Nick Radford, who lost to Sonico, got on the microphone and he announced that his father, Nick Radford Sr., purchased Project 42. So Nick Radford's father, apparently the brand new owner of the company.
Whoa, now this is right in the heart of Seattle. That's a lot of taxes, probably. Yes, one would think.
Well, apparently they are very wealthy. So Nick Radford told us, and I have confirmation from Buddy Highway, apparently he does not drink the demon alcohol.
Oh, wow, okay. Can you tell him what his best squat was in 2017, and at what he is aiming for in 2018. That's very important. The squat.
Well, I will see what I can do to confirm it. QT also missed one of your all-time favorites in the ring last night. Little Chocolate Drop, CJ Edwards, back in Magic for Project 42. He wrestled a guy named Kelly.
Who did he battle? I'm sorry.
A guy named Hellion was CJ's opponent.
Ooh, Hellion, huh? Sounds kind of ominous. Kind of like the dark clouds that are blanketing Seattle. Hellion.
Yeah.
How did Little Chocolate Drop do?
Well, he won the match.
Oh, okay. You can't do any better than that. Wow. Now, Sign Guy, was any Sign of the Times edited and issued out after the 3-2-1 battle Saturday?
That would be impossible because 3-2-1 was on Friday.
Oh, okay. What was any sign of the times issued on Saturday evening? That's what I'm saying.
It was. That's how we have that contest, which I mentioned earlier, which stemmed from episode 307. Perhaps you forgot the last 15 minutes of your life. But QT, I believe we have our guest with us. I want to bring him right on because I'm very anxious to have our guest this week. Been looking forward to it. Scott Bowden, are you with us?
I am with you.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here on New Year's Eve. And I want to start this off with our traditional first-timers question, since it's your first appearance on Turnbuckle Turmoil. What led to you getting into the business of professional wrestling?
The wrestling gods deemed it so. Having grown up in Memphis, you know, it's either, I think, you know, if you grew up in Memphis in the 60s, you probably, you know, had a garage band and, you know, Memphis was, sort of like being, it's sort of the equivalent of living in Hollywood right next to the MGM lot, you know, if you were into music. And as it got into the 70s and 80s and wrestling became so popular and Memphis, you know, it had the money probably to support an NFL team, or maybe a baseball team. For whatever reason, it just fell through. We almost got the Colts in the 70s, and it didn't happen. And so Memphis slowly became like a graveyard of minor league sports teams. And the one thing that consistently drew and attracted the fan base was pro wrestling. And I think that's because, the promoters there knew the art of storytelling. Now, they certainly weren't the best payoff guys in the world. Some of them were downright crooks. But when Jerry Jarrett came along, I think Jerry Jarrett was a good man. He paid better than Nick Gulas. Nick Gulas had even robbed him of several thousand dollars, which led to their split. And around the time that they got on Channel 5 and started the Lawler-Dundee feud, that's when I really started to take notice as a kid. You had, you know, these two guys just, you know, it was the same. It was remarkable because they went about 8 weeks or so with the same match involving the same two participants. But each week the stakes got a little higher and the stipulations got a little bit more outrageous. And it was riveting television. And they were able to draw, you know, between like 8 and 11,000 people every week. And they just had an incredible run, and that's what really lured me in. Initially, I didn't like wrestling. My dad would make my sister and I switch off our cartoons and turn it over to WHBQ back when the promotion was still run by Gulas. They were on Channel 13. But I remember looking up at the Mongolian Stomper, and gosh, what a perfect way to push a monster heel, you know, decades before Goldberg. They had him debut, and he beat two guys back-to-back who were kind of, you know, respected mid-card guys. I think Dennis Condrey, who went on to fame in the Midnight Express, and Jerry Bryant, who was sort of like a really competitive opening match jobber who got a lot of offense in. He actually just literally stomped them into submission back-to-back. And then he had the great Bearcat Wright, who was one of the most underrated promo guys in the world, doing his rap for him. So that was the first guy that kind of caught my eye. I was like, man, this is kind of cool. And then the Lawler Dundee thing, by the time that hit in the summer of 77, I was hooked. And that, well, that's sort of explains how I became a fan. And then,
sign.
Up, did we lose you? Up, did we lose Scott Bowden?
Uh-oh, I think we may have lost him.
I can hear you.
Oh, there we go. Now we can hear you.
Oh, there you okay.
All right. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, I was in a magazine writing class at Memphis State University, and I was on the newspaper staff there. I wrote for the alumni magazine, And Brian Lawler had just started wrestling. He was wrestling part-time under a hood with Tony Williams as the Twilight Zone, Nebula, and Quasar. And Brian, at that time, really, I don't think he anticipated that he would be a wrestler. He was actually a straight-A student at Craigmont High School and was really intelligent, believe it or not, given some of his more recent activities. But I think his way of getting into the business was to be closer to his dad, because Brian never really had a relationship with Jerry, because Jerry was always on the road, you know, and the wrestling business kind of it's not very well suited for family life. But that's the thing about the business. Once it gets in your blood, you know, it's hard to get out of it. And I worked a couple of outlaw shows with Brian as a manager, and I got to the point where I was able to kind of hang out backstage. And one day I made Jerry Lawler laugh, and we were kind of huddled around the monitor, and Eric Embry was cutting this promo on Lawler, and he goes, "Lawler, I've not never liked you." And me being a, you know, English major snob, I was like, double negative. That always gets heat. And for some reason, Lawler found that amusing. And they had just fired Jerry Calhoun as a referee. There's some kind of some rumors going around, about some stuff that maybe Lawler and Calhoun shouldn't have been doing on the road with some of the fans. That's really none of my business. It opened up a spot for me, and I took it. Initially, I think I was only supposed to referee, you know, that night. Jerry knew that I was doing an article on Brian. He goes, it'd be good research for your article, and we'll pay you $50. And he gave me a quick lesson in refereeing 101 backstage at the Mid-South Coliseum, and, you know, really teaching me the art of facial expressions. You know, if you see hair pulling, like, really, you know, that makes you angry. You know, you got to let the people know that that's not going to happen and that shouldn't happen. So that was my way in. It was basically through journalism and writing an article on Brian Lawler and hanging around backstage and managing not to anybody off kind of endearing myself to Lawler a little bit with my dry sense of humor.
Now, of course, you not only refereed, you also managed in Memphis for quite some time. You had a long-running feud with Jerry Lawler. You eventually, of course, were on his side for a while. When you first started working as a talent in Memphis, what was it like working alongside guys that you had grown up watching on TV on a weekly basis?
Dream come true. Very surreal. it felt natural to me, though. It felt like this is the way it was supposed to go. You know, like, I had such a strong connection to the business as a fan. I was emotionally invested as a fan. And I think that's a big thing that's missing today with WWE. You know, we could talk all day long about their booking decisions and those kinds of things, but a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, in the territory days, you know, Memphis, they ran every week. They ran not only Memphis, not only the Mid-South Coliseum every week, but Louisville every week and Evansville and Nashville. And then they would do spot shows and, you know, Jonesboro. And the Jonesboro shows were weekly. And then I think on Friday night would be the occasional, they'd go to Union City, Tennessee, the home of WWE Hall of Famer Coco Beware, and places like that. And they would draw a lot of money. You know, there might be only 800 people in a high school gymnasium, but with very little overhead. And they would pack the place, and they would get like probably half the concessions, sometimes all the concessions. So they were making a lot of money. They were putting on absolutely the best TV show at the time. I had lunch with Dave Brown the other day, and it was my understanding that the highest Memphis ever got in the rating, as far as like prime, like including primetime television, I always thought it was number three, but he said at one point that they were number two, right behind Dallas, I believe in 81 or 82. So that's an incredible reach for a local wrestling show. And you know, it it just when I got the chance to cut a promo with Lance Russell, you know, I've been practicing that. My friends and I sort of did backyard wrestling, but you know, we never dreamed of, you know, some of these backyard wrestlers take things to the extreme and bust Coke bottles over their heads and do moonsaults off the roof and things like that. We were never about that, because Memphis was such a great territory for guys who could talk on the mic and deliver a good promo. And so that was really the main competition with us. You know, it was like, who can, you know, cut the best promo. And so when Eddie Gilbert's idea to turn me heel, and I thought that it was going to be a permanent thing. I get the TV on Saturday, and I've got polo button down starched, and my fraternity, I was actually pledging a fraternity. I had my fraternity pin on. But I'd sort of been doing those things as a referee, because I was kind of wanted to transition into this role, but I never told anybody. But I was doing like little subtle things. Like, I mean, I was the best dressed referee you've ever seen. I always had the polo shirt, always had my fraternity pin. I had like shiny Doc Martin low cut shoes. I ruined so many like $50 and $70 button downs just because I would get blood all over them. Until Eddie Gilbert taught me a trick about washing stuff in cold that seemed to get blood out. But they told me to go out and apologize for kicking Jerry Lawler in the head when I turned heel. And I said, oh, huh. They said, yeah, you're going to become Eddie's manager for about 2 weeks, but because you're a rookie with no experience, you're going to make some mistakes and your interference is going to backfire and he's going to beat you up and fire you. And then we'll bring you back in a couple of weeks as a babyface referee. And I went, well, that's not really what I had. So, because I had to make a quick decision, you know, it's live TV. What the hell? And I went up there and I said, I'm not apologizing. I stomped Jerry Lawler like the cockroach that he is. And I was told that Lawler was incredulous backstage and, you know, probably pulled down the proverbial strap and was waiting for me when I came through the curtain. But it was so good. Lance adapted to it. And Eddie Gilbert came out, and it was a really great piece of television, and especially for a first time. But it felt like I'd been doing it my whole life, really, because you know, my friends would imitate Lance Russell when I was in eighth grade, and I would be Jerry Lawler cutting a promo. So it felt this, you know, perfectly natural for me. And when I walked back there, Lawler called me over, and he goes, "All right, that was good. But next time, go out there, say what we tell you to say."
One of the things that you have done in recent times is you launched the Kentucky Fried Wrestling podcast, which features a lot of audio from the old Memphis territory days, the USWA era, and even before that. It's a gold mine for fans of Memphis wrestling like myself. You and the great Brian Last, of course, on the Vanguard Network. What was the thought process when you decided to go with this? What were you thinking when the idea was first formed?
Well, I've been writing, you know, Kentucky Fried Wrestling started back in 99, I was working for an ad agency in Santa Monica with a guy named Chris Ryle, who today runs IDW comic book publishing company. And he was really into comics. My boss, Scott Tipton, was a big comics guy. I grew up a big comics guy as well. And so Chris somehow formed a connection with Kevin Smith, the movie director who, Chasing Amy and Clerks, and he was also writing comics. And I guess he found Chris through an internet forum where they were talking about comics. And Kevin said, you know, I got this promotional money from Miramax. And they said I could do whatever I wanted with it. And I want to start my own website. I want to be about comics, movies, like everything pop culture. And so Chris launched that and said, you know, hey, do you want to write a wrestling piece? And originally it was on Jerry Jarrett's first TNA show. And I said, sure. And I just thought it was going to be a one-off. And so the name of the article was Kentucky Fried Wrestling, or wrestling. And then they loved it. They thought it was great. And then they asked me if I would write a piece about Kurt Hennig, who passed away suddenly, like 3 days later. And Kurt was one of my favorites growing up. And so I wrote that. And lo and behold, there was a masthead all of a sudden. And I was listed with a regular columnist, and it said Kentucky Fried Wrestling. So, you know, that was meant to be the title of an article for a specific show, but it turned out to, you know, I don't know, it turned out to be a great fit. I was a big fan of the show Kentucky Fried Movie. There is like that Southern style of wrestling that I guess you could say is Kentucky Fried, and very noticeable. The Southern wrestling style is very noticeable. You know, baby faces who sell their asses off, who bleed a lot, make the comeback and either win or get screwed or whatever. But, you know, I think when Jerry Jarrett took over in the 70s, when I was, you know, old enough, I was about 6 or 7, to where I could sort of understand what was going on with it and follow the storylines. It really was a Shakespearean play. And that's the way that Jerry Jarrett likes to describe it. And Jerry Jarrett is a total gentleman. I mean, he's so well read. He knows more about poetry than most people I know. He carried that appreciation for Shakespeare and the arts into his storytelling of wrestling.
Now, recently on Kentucky Fried Wrestling,
excuse me for just a moment. And just in a roundabout way, I'm coming back around to your question. I was a guest on Jim Cornette's podcast that Brian Last produces. And I also I wrote an article about the big cage match with Jerry Lawler getting his head shaved at the hands of Austin Idol and Tommy Rich. And it was the 30th anniversary of it. And I posted my column and some clips of it. And it just went crazy. I mean, for a while there, I was trending. My name was trending on Twitter because I was the one who published this stuff. And fans were seeing this because Paul Heyman, you know, is such a popular character today in WWE. A lot of fans were seeing this footage for the first time, and they were shocked. You know, you see fans climbing the cage, you know, to get in to help Lawler, and them having to wait for a police escort to get out of the ring. And today's fans are just not used to seeing that kind of heat. And I think it opened a lot of eyes. And so I was a guest on Austin Idol show and, you know, told some funny stories there. And afterward, Brian Last called me and said, you know, I think that's the first time on Austin's show that the guest talked more than the host. Have you ever thought about doing your own podcast? And I said, yeah, sort of. And so that's how it all started. And around that same time, I got in my possession, you know, about 20 or so audio tapes that a kid in Memphis used to, you know, back before VCRs, he would sit down with his cassette recorder and tape the audio of the Memphis wrestling shows. So we have promos from Jerry Lawler and Sam Bass, Jackie Fargo, Jerry Jarrett, Tojo Yamamoto. We talked about the Stomper and his wonderful manager, Bearcat Wright. These promos have not been heard in 40 years. So it's really cool to be able to, you know, we don't have the video. They used to tape over all the shows. When I had lunch with Dave Brown the other day, he was lamenting the fact that, man, you know, these tapes were really big and they were really expensive, and we never dreamed that anyone would ever want to watch it again. And so we would just simply reuse them. And Jerry Jarrett told me that was the biggest mistake of his career. Like, if he could go back and do anything differently, he would have kept those tapes in pristine condition, because he could have probably doubled his money that he made in the business.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. Now, you recently on an episode went into detail about the Christmas Creature. It was one of the more entertaining podcasts I think I've heard you guys do since I've been listening in the last several months. For the people that may not have caught that one, since we're coming off Christmas, could you explain a little bit about the origin of the very infamous Christmas creature in the USWA?
Yeah, that, you know, a lot of people, when they think of Kane, Glenn Jacobs, they think of all the bad gimmicks that he had to endure. But a lot of fans, you know, they think of Isaac Yankum and the fake Diesel and Vinny Vegas, Oz. I'm getting some of these bad gimmicks confused with Kevin Nash. But anyway, Glenn Jacobs had this incredible run of really bad gimmicks, but it really all started in Memphis with the Christmas creature. But in Memphis, it, you know, a lot of people look at it and they go, that's totally ridiculous. But in Memphis always kind of get away with doing a lot of campy, fun stuff. And it was around the holiday season, and Glenn Jacobs was a green rookie. But he definitely had potential. He was not just your average musclehead who had shot up steroids and decided to be a wrestler. I think he was a fan of the business, so he sort of had a mind for it going in, and he had some athleticism to him. And so Lawler could pretty much carry anybody to a decent match. But he hadn't found his right gimmick yet. And it being around Christmas time, and they had just started working with WWF, and they were about to start sending talent there. And I think maybe they had sent the Bushwhackers once, but no, like Bret Hart hadn't appeared yet. None of the big guys at the time in the early 90s had appeared in Memphis. And so they had, and at the time, especially, Glenn Jacobs looked a lot like Sid Vicious. And so they thought, well, we'll dress him up as the Christmas creature, which was Kevin Lawler, his son, was always thinking of these different kind of crazy gimmicks that they could use. And he looks so much like Sid, is built so much like Sid. We'll imply it's a Christmas present from Vince McMahon to Jerry Lawler. And so in that sense, I mean, it actually kind of clicked and made sense. And Glenn did well. I mean, I refereed one of his first matches in the suit. He had been working, I think, for about 6 months previously as a Russian. And I remember thinking, like, man, this guy's got potential. Now, I never dreamed, you know, he'd go on to be a multiple-time WWF world champion and tag team champion and have one of the longest runs really on top or near the top than any other performer of the last 20 years. But he definitely, you could tell that the kid had something that night. And they used it for about 3 weeks. They got a lot of mileage out of that suit. And his mother actually, Kevin designed the suit. And the funniest part about it was, you know, they took his mother was a seamstress. And so she made the suit. But she made it almost like a tailor-made suit. She didn't, you know, it needed to be a little bit bigger to give him room to move in. So he felt like he was going to bust out of his suit at any moment throughout the whole thing. But working, you know, it's amazing. Working under that mask and in a very tight, he was able to come off pretty well as a kind of a bizarro Christmas monster heel.
Well, at this point in time, my co-host QT is standing by, and I know that QT has some questions also for you, so I'm going to pass things along to him for a bit.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Sun Guy. Hello, Scott.
Hey.
Scott, I listened to the start of Kentucky Fried Wrestling, and this particular episode was called Season Beatings from Memphis. And the first 30 seconds was filled with the music of what I believe is Beethoven's Fifth Overture. Am I right that this was one of Beethoven's compositions, or was it from Handel or Chopin?
Well, you know, it's a very highbrow show that we have.
Oh, okay.
So we're constantly, you know, featuring various it's also a pro wrestling podcast / look at classical music. I'm just kidding there. I believe what you're thinking of is the theme from 2001.
Oh, okay. All right. It probably was. Yes.
Yeah. That's the start of, Ric Flair has made that music kind of for his own, but for years it was, That was Jerry Jarrett's choice for music when he took over the rest. Basically, when he split off from Good List, the Channel 13 WHBQ music was very like rah rah rah. You know, it's like I can't even do it justice. I'm not even gonna try to sing it, but it was very sunny and very happy, you know, very positive. And then when Jarrett moved to Channel 5 and got Lawler and a lot of the younger guys to come with him, and eventually Lance Russell and Dave Brown joined him, he went a different direction. And you know, you have the infamous statue with the guys wrestling, and it looked just very classy. And 2001, it just, I believe it hit theaters and was a big hit. And the way if you understand Jerry Jarrett's, how he looks at the business, it just made sense, you know, because he looked at it, he wanted to stress that athleticism and the struggle of wrestling, but also have it be a little over the top and have these larger than life characters who could have come right straight out of a Shakespearean play. So the music sort of fit his philosophy. Some people thought it was pretentious, I think, but you know, I don't know when Flair started using it as his entrance music, but he was in Memphis in 82 for the live television show. Maybe he saw it and thought, hey, that's kind of cool. but that's pure speculation on my part. But we start every show like that. And I start every show by saying Yellow again, everybody, because that's what I woke up to every Saturday morning. That was Lance Russell's infamous greeting that he would start. It wasn't hello, it was Yellow. And it was like, you know, two guys sitting in your living room, watching the matches with you, and talking about it like two buddies watching a wrestling match. And that was the chemistry that Lance Russell had with Dave Brown. And I think that's one of the reasons why they were able to endear themselves so much to the fans, because they felt like neighbors and people you knew.
Oh, okay. All right. Very good. All right. Well, Scott, I also saw your YouTube video named Scott Bowden Gets a Letter from a Certain Someone's Wife, and the wife's name was Karen. Downtown Bruno was his name, I believe. Is it true that Downtown Bruno still leaves his dishes in the bathtub?
I'm not sure about that. Bruno and I actually get along very well. We come from completely different backgrounds. And Bruno had every right to probably hate me. You know, I mean, I'm this college kid who just kind of sneaks his way into the business where, you know, I think he ran away from home when he was like 13. And I think he joined the circus and did the carnivals and, paid a price really to be in the business. But he wasn't. He was such a nice guy. And he deserves every bit of success that he's had in this business. He still works to this day for Vince McMahon at WWF. I don't even know if they're aware he's still on the payroll, but because he doesn't cause any trouble, he does what he's supposed to, he does his job, and he just helps out at pay per views, and I think he helps out the road agents, and he's just an all around good guy. And we actually were doing this, Jarrett's philosophy and Lawler's philosophy, they like to take things that were going on in guys' personal lives, and transition that to television, because in their minds, a lot of promotions centered around the world championship. And when Memphis did that, they did it very effectively, but they did it sparingly. Basically, the reason why that promotion drew the ratings numbers they did and drew the houses they did was because everything was centered around very personal issues. They used to have a sign hanging in their office to remind them of this. Personal issues draw money. And so, obviously, Bruno getting a divorce, that was personal. And so we talked about it, and so everyone knew that you know, the fans were talking that, oh, Karen's leaving Bruno. And so we turned it into an angle where she was supposedly writing me letters and poetry. And it got so personal that Bruno asked me if we could stop it. And I thought that was really cool that he asked. I mean, he could have just told me, we're not doing this shit anymore. but he asked Randy Hales tonight. It hurts too much. And I felt bad about it. Yeah, because I felt bad about it because I was really pouring it on. And it was working. It was getting a reaction, but it just wasn't worth it, you know, to put Bruno through that kind of mental anguish. But I think the world of him. I saw him in an airport not too long ago, and he was nice as could be to me. And just a good dude, you know.
Oh, that's nice. That's good. Okay. Very good. All right. Well, Scott, did you ever have a chance to meet the great Moolah and Cyndi Lauper back in the early 80s? Cyndi Lauper.
Just a Lauper. No, not Lauper, only Lawler. But I'd rather have Lawler than Lauper. but no, I didn't. That was at a time when you know, WWF was starting to go in a different direction. Vince Jr. had taken over, and suddenly wrestling was on MTV. And I was into it. I thought it was cool. I was into it. But even as like I think I was 15 at that time, I could tell that the wrestling was not up to par, no matter how polished the product was. The first time I saw WWF on television was in 83. We finally got cable. And from reading the After magazines and the wrestling news, I hadn't discovered the newsletters yet, the dirt sheets. The way it was presented, it was like, oh, this is the big time, Madison Square Garden. And man, what a letdown. It was so boring. And I just thought Lawler could kill Bob Backlund, you know, if he ever got his hands on him. We all know that Bob Backlund would have, you know, killed Lawler in a legit suit. But at the time, the way it appeared to me that Backlund was a wuss. It's still sort of a mystery to me how he got over so well in WWF. But in another way, Bob had outstanding matches, and he almost provided a balance to some of the craziness. You know, he was a legit amateur wrestler, and so I think that's why that sort of clicked with the fans. But I never met Moolah, but I did work with Cora Combs, who was a legendary ladies wrestler, and her daughter. She was the original Lady Satan under a mask. And then she passed that gimmick on to her daughter. And then occasionally they would work the same card, and Cora would go back under the hood as Lady Satan, and Cora would work her. And I think one night I was managing Cora as Lady Satan against her own daughter. And Cora took a big bump, and I'm helping her up, and I'm hugging her. She's like, "Kiss me," and she tried to stick her tongue down my throat, and I was like, "No, I'm not going to do that. I'll do a lot for this business." But and then afterwards, she came up to me and she asked me, "Are you going to Louisville? Where are you staying?" And I was like, "Oh my gosh,
oh my,
she was in her 80s, but she could still, she was still ready to go."
Wow, Lady Satan. Okay. Wow. All right. Well, Scott, what were the cartoons that you were watching that your dad would make you turn off in favor of wrestling? I'm going to guess either Tom and Jerry or Bugs Bunny.
Bugs Bunny, without a doubt. So I've actually told the joke. I hosted a Memphis Roundtable discussion in one of the NWA Legends Fan Fest, and I had Lance there and Jerry Jarrett and Dave Brown, and that was a big thrill for me. And I explained how I got into it, and I said, you know, I wanted Foghorn Leghorn, but I had to settle for Lance Russell. And really, the difference was negligible between the two because they sort of had the same delivery. And Lance looked at me like, ah, you son of a gun. But, you know, it's kind of funny because Foghorn Leghorn was really Southern, and Lance could have that really homespun Southern delivery, like almost like a Mark Twain of wrestling approach to it. I think, and I still, Lance recently passed away, and was saddened deeply about that. Like I said, he carried me like a baby through my first promo, and a totally off the cuff line, he starts kind of telling me, if you're going to hang out with Eddie Gilbert, you know, people are going to judge you by the, you know, they judge your character by the folks you hang out with. And I, I was like, oh, okay, Dad. Okay, Dad. And he came up to me afterward. He goes, oh, man, that whole dad stuff, that was just great. I think Lance was the greatest wrestling announcer of all time, bar none. And, you know, he made it to 91. He had a hell of a life. And he had the chance to go back and do it all over again, because I'd be right there with him along for the ride.
Well, I was going to guess that with most of the wrestlers that you work with, most of them would describe you. My first choice was Foghorn Leghorn, and my second choice was Pepe Le Pew.
You're talking about me or Lance?
You. You.
Because maybe,
the
maybe,
only
maybe,
reason...
Maybe Pepe Le Pew, because I stunk in the ring. I was terrible with the physical. The promos kind of came naturally to me, but the physical stuff did not. I had to work, but I had no training. I don't know what they were thinking. And I don't, honestly, looking back on it, I don't know why once the decision was made for me to turn heel, or really even when I decided to keep refereeing after the initial evening, I don't know why I didn't probably seek out some veteran wrestlers to help me taking fall. I never had any training whatsoever. It was just learn on the fly. I took a pile driver, didn't know what I was, had no idea. I just trusted Lawler completely. And Lawler never hurt me in any way with a punch, except one time when I was in there with Randy Hales and I was laying some weak kicks in, and Lawler was scheduled to run in to make the save, and he did, and he clocked me upside. He hit me in a part that wouldn't break my jaw like he did with Paul Heyman and Jimmy Hart. But he let me know that he was not happy. And I remember, he popped me in the side of the head. I was seeing stars for a moment. So I was almost like a Wile E. Coyote. falling off a cliff, and I was seeing stars. And I got to the dressing room, and I thought, and Lawler comes up to me, and I'm thinking he's going to apologize for potatoing me. And he's like, hey, you know what that was? That was to wake your ass up. You need to lay those kicks in. And I went, oh, okay, got it. But then, I think 2 weeks later, we did a deal where I attacked Lawler, and I was kicking the ever-loving shit out of him. And he just goes, hey, lighten up. So, I think he kind of regretted that a little bit.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right.
But the philosophy was that especially in Memphis, too hard is fine, because if you accidentally break somebody's nose, the thing would be, it's a shame, but that's good for the business.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
They would rather it hurt a little bit, and the occasional broken nose or whatever, split lip, than for it to look lame and to look fake.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well, Scott, if you grew up in the '60s and '70s, do you remember a product called Silly Putty?
Well, I was born in '71, but yes, I do. I do remember Silly Putty.
Did you ever hit one of your childhood friends with frozen Silly Putty?
Boy. Probably not. I was more of a, I was never really into pranks like that necessarily. I was a big smartass all the time. So I wasn't pulling foreign objects, but I was definitely doing the Jimmy Hart, Jim Cornette type stuff, where I would just, exploit your weakness, find out, analyze you, find out what's wrong with you, keep it in my back pocket. And then if you ever said anything hurtful to me or came after me, I would just lay into you with a barrage of insults, and just probably, either make you cry or make you come after me with your fist. But, that was sort of my defense mechanism. That was my way of ribbing somebody. It was all verbal. I never got into the pranks and stuff like that.
Oh, okay. Okay. What did you think of the Andy Kaufman, Jerry Lawler feud?
Oh, gosh. it kind of blew my mind a little bit. I was, how old was I? 9, I think. And I went to Andy's first appearance at the Mid-South Coliseum where he wrestled women out of the audience. And it was less about going to see Andy and more just about, you know, everyone thinks, oh, they drew sellout. Andy Kaufman never sold out the Mid-South Coliseum. They got 10,000 fans there one night. And the night of the famous match, I think they drew where Lawler, you know, appeared to have hurt him in April of 82. That drew about 9,000. But that's kind of what they were drawing every week at that point. And that's sort of because Memphis at that time was in a period of transition. You had a lot of people leaving the city. All the baby boomers were leaving the city and going to the suburbs. And so going to the Coliseum became a little bit more of a difficult thing, especially if you had kids and you're getting off work. And but they were able to, I think they would have sold out more often had the situation not changed and more people had actually had the jobs and the houses and the homes and the families, had they stayed in the Memphis area, the central Memphis area, then I think they would have drawn a hell of a lot more money. But, you know, unfortunately, the Mid-South Coliseum was the only thing that would work. They had nothing. You know, we lived out in Bartlett, and at the time, there were very few restaurants out there. You know, eventually the restaurants came to us. But you know, my parents, for years, you know, if you wanted to go out to eat, we'd have to drive 20 minutes somewhere. And that was usually to a place called the Hungry Fisherman on Summer Avenue. It's not fine dining, I can assure you, but it was a fun little place. But so seeing Andy Kaufman on television blew my mind because my dad was a big fan of Taxi and, my dad was a big fan of movies. And so I watched a lot of stuff with him and I loved the Lotka character. And so to see Andy Kaufman come in and play, you know, this Hollywood star character, It was hard for me to figure out, you know, to see him on TV and then doing this. And I bought it, you know. I thought he was really just an asshole and a male chauvinist pig and the whole deal. And those matches, they were not works. He insisted on them being legit, which scared Jerry Jarrett to no end, because Jerry Jarrett was, you know, telling Andy, he's like, Andy, I'm telling you, one of these big plow women, you know, they'll clean your clock. You better be careful. They had one bout that was not a work initially with a African-American woman named Foxy, and it got out of hand and the crowd really reacted to it. And so when they brought that back in a rematch with Lawler in her corner to set up the bout between Lawler and Kaufman, that was the only one that was a work. But he I think he appeared twice in Memphis wrestling four different women on each night and pinned them all legitimately. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Oh,
which, gosh, I don't even know if I could do.
All right. Well, Mr. Bowden, it was very nice talking with you, and I hope you have a fantastic new year. And at this time, I'm turning it back over to Sign Guy.
Okay.
Thank you, QT. Well, Mr. Bowden, we got just a couple moments left on the show, so I want to give you the time. If there's anything you would like to say to the listeners, plug and promote anything you got, social medias, merchandise, the podcast, anything at all, floor is all yours.
You can check out my podcast. We've been sort of bouncing around a little bit between Saturdays and Monday nights. The reason for that, my sister unfortunately passed away unexpectedly, and obviously that affected me a great deal, and I'm still in Memphis. I live in Los Angeles. I was planning to come to Memphis for Christmas, but I ended up coming out sooner, and I just you know, couldn't do a show for a while. So we came back last Saturday on a show. You'll either find us on Saturdays at 11 a.m. at kfrpod.com or on Monday nights at 8 o'clock Central. No, those two times have significant meanings to longtime Memphis fans because the 11 a.m. show was a staple of everyone's life on Saturday mornings. And Monday night at the Mid-South Coliseum, the matches always started at 8 o'clock Central. So we'll be on tomorrow night at 8 o'clock Central. And I'm not quite sure. We're we're debating whether or not we're going to keep it on Saturdays or Mondays. But either way, right now there's like 7 great episodes up, and they're packed. We don't do a lot of, you know, BSN on the show. We don't talk, you know, we get right into the material. And those shows are packed with like rare audio clips that fans haven't heard in years. We have Jerry Lawler's first babyface promo ever after Sam Bass turned on him. We have the angle where Sam Bass betrayed the Young King along with Phil Hickerson. We have Bill Dundee's first interview in the studio with George Barnes, which is fantastic. Just all kinds of great stuff. And you have my commentary on it, me telling stories about those guys. And I think it's a cool 90 minutes that flies by. You can also find me on Twitter at Trav Scott Bowden. And you can also find me on Facebook at Kentucky Fried Wrestling. And that's RASSLIN. Because where I come from, wrestling is not a derogatory term. It is a term of endearment.
Well, Scott Bowden, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here today. I appreciate it greatly. And I wish you continued success with Kentucky Fried Wrestling. It's a great, great show. If you're a fan of Memphis wrestling, I very highly recommend it to you. Even if you're just a fan of wrestling from the territory days in general, I think you'll really enjoy it. We will be back with you next week. A week from today, we'll be joined by the Bambino family out of the Midwest. Great, great faction that is making waves in the Midwest right now are the Bambinos. We'll have them on. Be safe tonight for New Year's Eve. Everyone, get where you're going safely. Get back home safely. And we'll talk to all of you in 2018.
Just before.